We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. Or visit preborn.com.
The 2024 Ten Commandments Project Speech Challenge is a great way to teach children and youth between 7 and 17 to lead a life that honors God. Just have them write a 3 to 5 minute speech on the topic, Why Are the Ten Commandments Important? Then use your cell phone or other means to record them reading the speech and submit it by June 30th. Find out all the details and upload your recording at afr.net/Ten Commandments. That's afr.net/Ten Commandments.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. And breaking this morning, I just want to flag this for you really quickly. I just posted on my X account. You can follow at Jenna Ellis ESQ. Breaking, a Michigan judge has just ruled that the Democrat Secretary of State's election manual that was issued to local election officials is unconstitutional and violates state law. So the court is also mandating strict signature verification for mail-in votes in the upcoming 2024 election. This is very good news. You can read that full opinion that I just posted to my social media account. That's been flagged by, of course, colleagues like Cleta Mitchell, who's doing really good work at the Conservative Policy Partnership Institute, rather. And of course, this can be appealed through the regular course of process. And the challenge is that the Michigan Supreme Court, of course, is controlled by Democrats. So we can only pray that they follow the law rather than political ideology. But yesterday, the big news is that the House voted to hold Attorney General Merrick Garland in contempt of Congress for failing to hand over audio tapes of the Robert Hur special counsel interview of Joe Biden in the classified documents case. They've received the transcript, but not the audio. And the only conclusion potentially that we can draw, this is according to Guy Benson on X, Garland is withholding the Biden slash Hur audio recording for obviously political reasons. His excuses make no sense. Yes, Republicans want the tape for politics, too, but that's not a legal justification for the Attorney General's stonewall. We can draw conclusions about how bad the tape must be. So this was the third time in American history that a sitting Attorney General has been held in contempt of Congress. The prior two, of course, were Eric Holder under the Obama administration for the Fast and Furious scandal, and then, of course, the Bill Barr, when he declined to hand over the full unredacted Mueller investigation report to Congress during the Trump administration. Neither of those contempts of Congress resulted ultimately in criminal proceedings or charges. So will this be any different for Merrick Garland? Well, joining me now to discuss is Congressman Ben Klein, who is from the great state of Virginia, member of the Freedom Caucus, and also serving on the House Judiciary Committee. So, Congressman, good morning. Thank you so much. And, you know, I think this was a huge win for Republicans.
It is, Jenna, and it's good to be with you. It's good to be with a fellow University of Richmond Spider law grad. And,
yay.
You know, the passage of this resolution was important for Congress to assert. It's on the same level as the presidency when it comes to separation of powers. And when it comes to our ability to get information from the executive branch, especially when we're in an impeachment inquiry, which we are, and the Judiciary Committee and the Oversight Committees are investigating this administration, we get to decide what we want from this administration when it comes to the form in which the information comes. So if it's a transcript or if it's a tape, that's our decision, not the administration's decision about what they want to provide us.
And so what has been the justification for Attorney General Garland to not hand over that audio tape? I mean, you all have the transcript, so it would seem like the audio would be helpful to you as well, but there's no real reason. There's going to be nothing new in terms of the content of the audio. So what's the reason that he's not just handing it over?
Well, and that is a great source of discussion amongst my colleagues. Essentially, what we're all saying is there must be something really, really damaging on these tapes. And what we're really looking for is not necessarily that they've been doctored, although they have been changed, because a lot of the pauses and ums, some of those have been removed from the written transcript, and they admitted as such. And so that even increases our reasoning for getting the tapes. But, you know, when you listen to someone talk, you can get a better indication of their frame of mind. And so for them to be holding this back with no justification, they claim executive privilege, but when they gave us the transcript, they waived executive privilege because they've given us all of the information. So there really is no privilege that they can claim. And so they're obliged to give us the tapes. And unfortunately, it's going to be hard to get them from the Attorney General, because the contempt resolution goes to the Justice Department for decision-making about criminal charges. And of course, they're not going to charge themselves. So it is frustrating.
That is. And that answers, in part, my next question. I'm speaking with Congressman Ben Klein from the great state of Virginia, who's a member of the Freedom Caucus and the House Judiciary Committee. And that, you know, what happens next? Because it seems like there should be some way, if the DOJ is disqualified, because obviously it won't charge itself, that there should be some other kind of special prosecutor or some other type of process that could be appointed to look into a sitting AG? Or is the answer then just to initiate potential impeachment charges as well over a violation of contempt of Congress if Garland doesn't choose to ultimately comply?
Right. You mentioned that the other two cases in which sitting attorney generals were held in contempt, it was because they refused to hand over information to Congress. And because of the separation of powers, we have Article 1 powers, legislative powers, but Article 2, the executive branch has the law enforcement powers. And so it is very challenging for us. We have the tools at our disposal include impeachment, but are very limited after that. And so while some are talking about further litigation, it's more likely that impeachment is our available action. And we see what the Senate has done with Mayorkas. We impeached Mayorkas. I was honored to be named a manager. We walked down, we read the impeachment resolution to the Senate, and without hearing any evidence at all, they dismissed it. So I don't think that an impeachment of the Attorney General would get us where we want to be with this Senate. So it's very frustrating right now that the Attorney General can continue to thumb his nose at justice while he also turns and focuses his attention on the lawfare that's being waged against the former president.
Yeah, and this is so frustrating because it seems like then with the DOJ not being willing to charge itself or even investigate itself, and then the Senate effectively neutering the impeachment power, then what really are you left with? I mean, is there some kind of legislative solution that could be potentially provided, perhaps not for this instance, but to solve this type of stonewalling in the future?
Well, we are considering legislation that Congressman Russell Fry from South Carolina has introduced, which would allow the president, like other elected officials, members of Congress, to elevate their cases against them from the state level to the federal level. So this doesn't directly affect our issue, but it would actually give the president or someone who is charged with a crime, for example, like in the Bragg instance or in Fannie Willis's case in Georgia, to elevate those to the federal level and not allow this lawfare to continue to be waged against the former president by local prosecutors. But as for the DOJ's efforts to wage lawfare against the former president, it still does not give us the tools that we need to prevent this kind of activity.
Wow. And that's really a loophole that they found in the process that doesn't allow for any of the coordinate branches really to hold them accountable. And so, you know, where does this go from here in terms of Biden's impeachment? Has there been any discussion on Capitol Hill among Republicans, assuming that Republicans still control the House after November, and whether or not Joe Biden is reelected? We've certainly seen that precedent with former President Trump that impeachment can happen after a president leaves office. So is there any discussion that that would continue even if Joe Biden is not reelected?
It's all on the table. One thing that we continue to have is the power of the vote, the power to communicate with our elected officials, with our constituents back in the district, and their ability to communicate with their elected officials. And elections are coming very soon. 5 months is a very short time. We are optimistic that Republicans are going to hold the House and take back the Senate, and we'll be able to provide a coordinated response to this kind of malpractice by attorneys general. Now, hopefully we're going to have President Trump in the White House at that point, and so we will all be marching in the same direction forward when it comes to legislation and when it comes to what we need to do to reverse all of the slides that we've seen over the last 4 years with inflation, with the global wars that we're seeing erupt all across the globe, the fact that this president is inept when it comes to foreign affairs and keeping our families and our communities safe, the flood of illegal migrants coming across the border. So we're optimistic that this election is going to be a positive one. And in fact, Donald Trump is coming up to the Republican conference this morning at 9:30 to speak to the conference and hopefully give us some great messaging going forward.
That's great. And this, and Speaker Johnson did say about that meeting that it's important to coordinate and to get Republicans all together and on the same page. And you know, one of the things that that I've heard from a lot of our audience here at the American Family Radio Network has been the question of why it's taken so long to get to a potential impeachment of Biden. I mean, this started initially when he was first in office, but at least when Republicans took over the House. And I know there's been a change in leadership, you know, between McCarthy and Johnson now, but it seems like this just keeps being a possibility, but never really materializing.
Yeah, and this is where the slow walking of a lot of this information that's been demanded by the impeachment inquiry by the Judiciary Committee, by the Oversight Committee, has been successful on the part of the Biden administration. You know, they've refused to provide documents. We've gone to court. The courts have said in many cases you have to provide the documents. They'll provide us dribs and drabs and pages here and pages there. And it has pushed the impeachment conversation into a presidential election year, which was their that was their goal from the very beginning, so that they could call it political. Now it is being called political, but that does not stop us from our determination to get to the bottom of why Joe Biden has tens of thousands of dollars coming into his own bank accounts from family members who have been meeting with foreign adversaries. And this connection is becoming clearer and clearer. And if it's not clear enough for Congress to act on impeachment, which I believe that we should have gone down the road of this impeachment inquiry, and that it is becoming clear that Joe Biden has abused his oath of office. But if it's not clear enough for my colleagues, for a majority of my colleagues, then it's going to be clear enough for the American people. And getting that information out to them is going to be essential as well.
Yeah, and really well said, Congressman Ben Klein, that this isn't political. And Speaker Johnson, even before he became Speaker, he said very clearly that that he will follow the facts and the evidence where it leads. And this type of this investigation has been ongoing. And so it's so frustrating when the media spin and the court of public opinion politicize it just because it is an election year and they're essentially trying to just run out the clock on this. So I appreciate all of the work that you do in Congress, and also especially with the Freedom Caucus, and with Congressman Bob Good there. He's a friend of the show, and I really appreciate you joining this morning to give us that update. So Congressman Ben Klein, you can follow him at Rep Ben Klein, C-L-I-N-E, on X, and we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show, and that's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you, we need to save them. That's why we've partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears that heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies. And that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or $140, helps to rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just dial #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And a federal judge has stricken a Florida ban on so-called gender-affirming care for children. This coming from Politico. The judge also blocked requirements that would make accessing the so-called care, which is just gender mutilation for a transgender adults. And this is such a ridiculous opinion, and it is so ideologically based. And yet the judge said in his opinion that there is no governmental interest in banning this type of so-called gender-affirming care, and it is purely ideologically based. And so a federal judge is stepping in and saying that the Florida legislature and Governor DeSantis can't actually manage and protect their own citizens, which is exactly what the Constitution provides for in our entire notion of federalism. And so the press secretary for Governor DeSantis responded back and said, Jeremy Redfern, and he said that this will be appealed. And so joining me now to discuss all of this and more is Gerard Felitti, who is the Lawfare Project senior counsel, among many other great things that he does. And Gerard, this is beyond ridiculous in this specific instance, but so let's talk about that first, and then I do want to get to this whole idea of a federal judge coming in and telling the state of Florida how they can protect their kids or not.
It's really shocking that a federal judge would come in and say that a state essentially does not have an interest in protecting its citizens when that is the most important obligation of a state. And here, Florida looked at science. They looked at studies that were done in the UK and Europe, even in America, and found that there's nothing that's really beneficial about these surgeries, that they're risky, that they can impose lifelong consequences on children and basically mutilate them in many ways. This is something that could be stopped by the Florida legislature. This is something the Florida legislature stepped in to stop. And now a court is imposing its own morals. This judge, this federal judge, is imposing his morals on the people of the state of Florida and basically saying science doesn't matter because we believe, or I believe, that gender-affirming surgery is so important.
And this is where it's so remarkably absurd, because you're right. Florida is actually following the science. And if we want to set aside the fact that, you know, all law is ideologically based to some extent, I mean, what we allow and permit in society versus what we prohibit, and this whole notion of criminal law, but then also some of these statutes as well that either allow or prohibit things like these types of so-called gender-affirming care, which is such a nonsensical term. It's based in someone's ideology. And so the court is, as you said, superimposing its own ideological view. But if we want to even just set all of that aside, science does show, and I thought the left was the party of science, that there are only two genders. It's perfectly observable. That's what our founders would have called self-evident truth. And so where does this type of precedent get us when you have federal judges that are making these kinds of ridiculous claims? We had the Supreme Court of Hawaii a couple of months ago invoke the spirit of aloha. I mean, their ridiculous ideology to manufacture the outcome that they prefer. I mean, this is an abuse of the judicial institution and substituting activism for judicial restraint.
It absolutely is, and this is judicial activism at its finest. It's not looking at a law that exists and enforcing it to the benefit of people. It's not, for example, enforcing civil rights protections, because there is no civil right in life-altering surgery or life-altering medical treatment that deals with gender assignment or so-called gender assignment. So really, it's a court, it's the judicial branch imposing its view to craft how society deals with something, when that is something that is left up to voters who elect legislators who make laws about that. So this is where we have a problem. We have a problem because we have a federal judge who is stepping in on state rights, on the rights of state citizens, to decide for themselves how best to handle an issue and how best to protect their fellow citizens. And this is not done in accordance with any greater legal theory. This is done in accordance with what this judge personally believes. And that is an overreach, and that is something that needs to be overturned on appeal.
Yes, and I'm speaking with Gerard Folletti, who is an attorney in the Lawfare Project senior counsel. And so Governor DeSantis's office has pledged to appeal this. We got a question from a reporter yesterday at a press conference asking if taxpayer resources should be used to fight this ideological battle. And he just came out and said, well, because it's wrong. And of course, we're going to fight this. And we've seen taxpayer dollars go to actually way more ridiculous things than protecting the valid interests of state legislatures to legislate and to carry out their actual obligations. But where does this go from here in terms of appeal?
In terms of appeal, this will go up to the circuit, and this will probably end up before the Supreme Court, because we have many states that have passed similar legislation. We've had it struck down in Arkansas. It's being challenged in Tennessee. It'll be challenged in other states as well. And this is something that inevitably the Supreme Court will need to rule on, although we can't expect that anytime this year, maybe not even next year. But this is something that is of such national importance, because it is something that affects all of us. It is, you're right, people have ideologies that go into making laws. But more than that, as a society, we want to be safe. And we want to be safe not just from medical procedures that are gone awry, but from other people imposing their political doctrine on us. And that is the greatest threat here, because we're not able to choose for ourselves what laws we enact. We're not able to choose for ourselves how to keep our children safe. We're being told by unelected judges, essentially, what we need to do and what we're allowed to do. And that's not how our system of government is supposed to work.
You're absolutely right. And so, you know, with this likely going all the way up to the Supreme Court, which is still part of the federal government, what should the holding and the opinion ultimately be? And I know we're kind of getting a little bit ahead of that, but I mean, do they even need to reach the inquiry and the merits here, or should this just be simply an issue of federalism and saying, you know, no, the Florida has the right to legislate on this topic?
They will probably need to reach the merits because the underlying argument is that this is a civil rights violation. So they will have to address the facts and the law. But I think federalism will be a part of this. It may not be the deciding factor, but it will certainly motivate the court into how it approaches this. Because I think we are seeing on the part of Justice Roberts and the majority in the court more importance being placed on strict constitutional interpretation of state rights. So that will play a role, absolutely. But this will also help redefine what exactly is protected by civil rights statutes, whether we are looking at things that are as untested as so-called gender-affirming treatment, or whether we keep it to more traditional notions of race, gender, religion, and national origin. I think that's going to be important as well, because many groups are trying to sneak in protections or benefits for their identifiable groups, whatever they may be, by claiming civil rights protections. And while we need to be very vigilant and enforce properly civil rights, we can't embrace everything as a civil right either.
Right. That's very well said, because civil rights should be contained just to the contours that absolutely make sense, not this ever expanding and ever increasing. I mean, it seems like civil rights to the left are now just as a vague and you can manipulate it into a pretzel as much as they can, adding more genders. I mean, we don't even know what the state of New York, I mean, they'll end up with, what, 1,700 by, you know, next year? I mean, it's utterly ridiculous. And so this ever-increasing expansion of so-called civil rights protection seems to be just the pretext for the left to impose their ideology through those types of lawsuits. So in terms of how conservatives need to fight back against that, because in the court of public opinion, of course, it's not generally popular to say, well, we're against civil rights, which is how the left frames it. But we need to remember that this is all about originalism. It's about protections, and it's about ensuring that states can exercise legitimate powers like the state of Florida did in this legislation. So how, from a legal perspective, should conservatives wage that battle?
Well, the strongest argument here, I think, is that this is within the purview of a state. It's looking at what a state's rights are and what the Constitution says about what a state can do and how it can go about doing it. And if you look at it that way, you will see that what Florida did was perfectly within the bounds of the Florida Constitution and the U.S. Constitution. If you apply that analysis, you look and see that the judge overreached and there was nothing here for the judge to decide. But the other thing is, focus on the fact, focus on the science. Ironically, it's the people on the left who keep saying it's about science and that Republicans or conservatives ignore science for morality. In this case, it's the other way around. It's this motivation, this ideologically driven left wing that is looking at science and disregarding it and saying it's about our feelings. Let's ignore the science. Let's ignore what we know to be dangerous to children because we believe that things should be otherwise. So in this case, also focus on the science because that's important and that's very supportive of what this legislation does.
Yeah, and this Gerard Folletti, who is my special guest this morning, the Lawfare Project senior counsel, this raises a broader question. We're talking about judicial activism of judicial reform overall and why appointments to the federal bench are so very important. And that really hasn't become, at least in terms of most of the campaign messaging and topics, you know, the border invasion and the economy have been mostly the talking points. But back in 2016, with the vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court, that was one of the primary issues that I think compelled conservatives to ultimately put Donald Trump in office. And how important should conservatives understand the federal judiciary, not just the Supreme Court, but all the way down the bench? I mean, this federal judge was a Clinton appointee. I mean, all the federal judges are nominated by a sitting president. So how important is it for conservatives to understand that when contemplating their vote for November?
It's very important. And what people need to remember is that even though judges are supposed to, they're supposed to try cases, what they end up doing is making policy and making law. Why? Because Congress is lazy. Because over many, many decades, Congress has gotten out of the practice of drafting explicit legislation and written these vague laws that are left for interpretation by the executive, by political appointees in whatever department may be. And when they come up with rules, those rules get challenged in court, and then the court decides what those rules mean. So you start with Congress. You start with the premise that American voters elect people to make laws that benefit them. But those laws are not specific enough to actually do anything, which means the courts step in and make law, make policy. They decide what things mean when it may not be what the intent was. So when you're voting, you have to bear in mind that you're voting for people who will appoint those judges who they shouldn't be doing this, really. I mean, it's up to Congress. It's up to state legislatures. But judges have a tremendous impact in deciding what the law actually is. And we've also seen how they affect the outcome of elections. We also see how they affect the outcome of our public policy. So this is crucial. It's just as crucial as the economy, the border security, crime, and the culture wars that we're fighting for the future of our country. You need judges who understand what their role is and apply it properly.
Yeah, and you're so right that Congress is so lazy, and they have essentially abdicated their role largely by these vague statutes that then get interpreted by the executive bureaucrats that comprise, you know, the deep state and the swamp, and then have largely also abdicated to the judicial branch, which was never intended to be the strongest branch of government, but now we are essentially an oligarchy that is run by, you know, these nine robed justices with so many issues that shouldn't even go in front of the Supreme Court, but then are decided based on ideological lines. And so, and I spoke about this recently on the program, but would love to get your take, Gerard, on this headline coming from The Hill. Democrats see Supreme Court leverage in spending bills, and Carrie Severino, who is with the Judicial Network, tweeted this: Democrats are threatening to defund the Supreme Court as a way to force Chief Justice Roberts to adopt so-called ethics reforms in the wake of more manufactured controversies ginned up by the left. Democrats, I think, seek to often wield their power in ways that aren't quite as lazy, perhaps, as Republicans. How do you see that whole topic of a potential defunding of the Supreme Court, or at least a threat from the left on Congress?
I think you're increasingly seeing the strategy of the left. When they don't like an outcome, they want to change the rules. If you don't like who people want to vote for president, you know, prosecute the guy. If you don't like what the Supreme Court is coming up with, pack it with more justices so you get a favorable outcome. And now their strategy is cut funding or threaten to cut funding because you don't like what the rulings are. And it strikes me as richly ironic because they're not, you know, for people who pretend to play by the rules or value the law and order. We just heard President Biden speak about that the other day. That's not what they're doing. They want to stack the deck. They want to change the system, or at least threaten the justices with financial instability, essentially as a check on the power of the Supreme Court. And that's not what the Constitution says. This is overreach by the legislature over the Supreme Court. Now, if you don't like what the Supreme Court is doing, you change that in the ballot box. You vote for a president who will appoint justices to your liking. You don't cut funding, and you don't threaten to pack the court with more people. That's destabilizing for a system of government. Yet that's exactly what Democrats are promising.
Yeah, and it seems like they're just wanting intentionally to weaponize any of their powers and to make them so overbroad just to force their own objectives. And we're seeing that with a lot of the lawfare. We're seeing that with a lot of the legislation, even some of their responses to Republicans, like refusing even to hear the impeachment trial of Secretary Mayorkas. I mean, and effectively neutering Republicans' power of impeachment while they control the majority. So there's so much more to discuss about reforms and our whole constitutional process. And this is why I'm so glad that we have at least an hour every morning. But I always tell Tim, you know, we could fill 5 hours of content every morning. But Gerard Folletti, thanks so much. And you can follow him on social media. He is the Lawfare Project Senior Counsel. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And we talked on the top just about that breaking news this morning that a Michigan judge has just ruled that the Democrat Secretary of State's election manual issued to local election officials is unconstitutional and against state law. This judge is also mandating a strict signature verification for mail-in votes in the upcoming 2024 election. And so from this judge, Christopher Yates, quote, the court declares that the initial presumption of validity in signature verification of absentee ballot applications and envelopes mandated by the December 2023 guidance manual issued by defendants is incompatible with the Constitution and laws of the state of Michigan. For similar reasons, the court declares that the catch line referring to a, quote, initial presumption of validity is incompatible with the Constitution and the laws of the state of Michigan. Accordingly, those provisions must be excised from the guidance manual and the catch line. So you can read that entire opinion that I've posted on my my social media accounts on we've currently posted it just on X, formerly known as Twitter. I will at the end of the program post it on my Facebook page as well. And Cleta Mitchell, who is the who is a senior partner for the Conservative Partnership Institute in D.C. Is going to be our special guest this morning, and we are still trying to, my producers are saying that we're still trying to get a hold of her. So as soon as she can come on, hopefully we will have her commentary on this. If we can't reach her today, you know, sometimes that happens when we're on live radio, and we will just go ahead and cover that topic in another program. But we'll go ahead and still try to get a hold of her. But I would encourage you to read this opinion, and, you know, this is a great start to the 2024 election. It's really good that the Republican National Committee and those plaintiffs are challenging some of these things up front. This is what we saw in a lot of the aftermath of the last election, that a lot of these were kicked out, you know, based on standing or other issues that it was after the election. And so this is always very good that we're litigating some of this up front and making some of these determinations. Unfortunately, you know, as Cleta was telling me this morning, that the Michigan Supreme Court is controlled by Democrats. And so we should pray that that the court, if and when they receive this appeal, which they will likely, that they will follow the law instead of political ideology or politics. And we just talked about that in the last segment about judicial activism and the fact that judges should not be politicians. They should not be making determinations and rulings and opinions based on their own desire to see a preferred outcome. That is what happens when judges go to the bench. They have to remove their bias. I mean, just like a jury comes in, and when they are sitting as a selected juror, they are fact finders. They have to set aside any preconceived bias that they might come in with. And now that doesn't mean that, you know, their life experience and other things and logic and ability to analyze evidence and all of that can't come into play. But their bias, if they have a bias one way or another, then they may not necessarily be a good fit on a particular jury. And judges very often, and in my experience on many jury trials as a litigator, so many judges will often tell jurors that and say, just because you may not be a good fit for this particular case doesn't mean you're not a good juror overall, but we want to make sure that it's fair to both sides. And judges, similarly, when they aspire to the bench, they have to put aside the whole idea of advocacy. And one of the main reasons that I frankly have never wanted to be a judge, and you know, and there are a lot of lawyers that's kind of the penultimate aspiration of, you know, instead of going and advocating, then, you know, you finally get to decide things. And there's a whole segment of lawyering practice that aspires to the bench. One of the reasons that I just never wanted to be a judge in in my legal career was because I didn't want to set aside the advocacy element. That's one of the things that I love about litigation. It's one of the things that I love about media and about coming on the radio every morning, is that I actually get to advocate and talk about opinions and advocate for conservative propositions. And so I'm being told we do have Kalita Mitchell. So Kalita, thanks so much for joining today. And sorry for the tech issues probably on our end. But this is a really important opinion here, that the judge seems to simply be following the law instead of some political bias. So what's going on in Michigan? And let's break this down.
Okay, well, thank you, Jenna, and I'm sorry for the tech issues also. I don't know what's going on, but let me just, the little history here is that Jocelyn Benson is the Democrat Secretary of State of Michigan, and she's a far-left activist, zealot, and she issued a guidance manual before the 2022 election, which basically she just made up. And there were parts of it, many parts of it, that were a direct conflict with the statute and the state constitution. Now, unfortunately, on the 2022 ballot in Michigan, there was a proposition that the left-wing groups put on the ballot and told everybody it was to strengthen voter ID. And in fact, it did just the opposite, but it basically put in a lot of things into the state constitution that we would not like, that we fight against. And they had to lie about it. That's what I think is so interesting. They had to lie to the people about what was in it in order to get it passed. So they told people to strengthen election integrity, just did the opposite. But the RNC sued Benson before the election of 2022, saying that the guidance manual was wrong and violated the law, the state's law and constitution. And this is one provision of the constitution that did not change. There's no presumption that the signatures on absentee ballots are valid. And she put into the manual that the signatures on an absentee ballot envelope, which is the way they verify identity of people who vote by mail, that those would be presumed to be valid. And they sued, and RNC won, but she got the opinion stayed through the 2022 election. And so then it was renewed, and this decision, it actually is, it's a little, there are two provisions in this lawsuit. There were a number of other provisions that were challenged, but they're not addressed in this opinion. And this opinion, the judge agreed with the RNC and the other plaintiffs, saying that you could not presume that the signatures would be valid, that that is not in the Constitution, and they couldn't make that. The election officials, the town clerks who run the elections in Michigan, could not presume that the signatures were valid. There's another section of the opinion, though, and the reason I mention this is because it will be interesting to see what happens in terms of filing an appeal. And that is that there are statutes that say that there are other factors that a clerk could look at in order to try to determine if the signature was of the person who had originally registered to vote, if this was the actual voter. And one of there are two or three factors, like looking at the person's age. Our signatures sometimes get more wobbly as we age. And so look at the person's age. Look at are there health factors? And so there are some subjective provisions in the law, but the judge said, and the judge did not eliminate those. Those were challenged by the RNC, but the judge said, no, those can remain. They do not. They do not violate the state constitution. So now the question is, each of the parties won and lost one. The more important one, I do think, is the presumption of validity that Benson had tried to slip in and had written into the guidance book. But I don't know whether the RNC will appeal that, or whether the DNC or the Benson will appeal that, the part that she lost. And so, because there was a little bit in it for everybody, the more important one is the presumption of validity of the signature. And the Supreme Court of Michigan, so now let's talk about the politics. The Supreme Court of Michigan, where this would go, And I don't know the answer whether there's an intermediary court that would have to hear it first. It seems my recollection is that there is. But ultimately, the Michigan Supreme Court is now controlled by the Democrats, similar to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So Benson may be make a decision that she can get her cake and eat it too if she files an appeal. So that's kind of what we're dealing with in Michigan, because we don't have good courts in Michigan, because our people don't turn out and vote in judicial races, and then the judges end up making all the laws instead of the legislature. So,
and I'm speaking with Cleta Mitchell.
That's where we are, Jenna.
Yeah, thank you so much, because I'm speaking with Cleta Mitchell, who's the Senior Legal Fellow for the Conservative Partnership Institute and the chair of the Election Integrity Network, has been doing a really great work on these issues, and then on, all of the important voter issues heading into 2024. We've had her on a number of times on this program to talk about, all of the Democrats' push to get the right to vote to illegals, and, all of these other things that ultimately undermine our ability as American citizens. For only us, we should be the only ones that are voting in elections, and that shouldn't be controversial, but somehow it is. So if this is appealed to the Michigan Supreme Court, and I had asked Cleta before the program, if there was an intermediary, and whether or not there is, it would likely get to the Michigan Supreme Court, and then potentially, further than that, to the U.S. Supreme Court, if there are other issues, because this may impact the presidential election. And so could it potentially go all the way up? And is that a factor of consideration on whether or not either side would appeal?
Well, I think that, hopefully one of the things that you mentioned, I tell people very strongly, for Republicans, for President Trump, but for Republican candidates generally, there are no post-election remedies available to us anymore. I don't care what the statutes say. After living through what we lived through, and Jenny, you know this better than anybody, from everything you've been through. But in the post-election of 2020, we had courts ruling that President Trump, as the candidate for president, that he or his campaign did not have standing to bring election challenges to his own election. And yet, these same courts grant standing to any fake or phony or real left-wing organization that comes in and challenges election laws. It has evolved over a period of many years. Republicans haven't done anything about it, and so we've suffered the consequences. And I just don't. And we saw what happened in Arizona when Carrie Lake and Abe Hamadeh filed challenges to their elections. There's still a court challenge pending for the Republican Attorney General candidate of Arizona, and there are fewer than 200 votes separating him and the person who is declared the winner, the Democrat who's declared the winner, and there are more than that many votes that are yet to be counted, that are just sitting waiting for a court to address, and they have been filed. That's been going on for almost 2 years. So I think it's really important. I tell everybody, whatever we're going to get done, we have to do before the election, because the courts have just closed their doors to Republican candidates and to President Trump for any post-election redress.
And I'm glad to see that there are challenges up front. And in just the last minute I have with you, Cleta, I mean, just that example in Arizona, I mean, this is going on, almost 2 years now. Why isn't the court hearing that and deciding? Because, if there was some kind of outcome determinable opinion, now it's, 2 years later, and that would cut into, of course, the term of an attorney general.
Right. It's just insane. And don't forget that. I think the judicial, remember, if you look at the data, here's my conclusion. Lawyers and judges all have multiple years of education, college and post-college, post-secondary, post-college degrees, have graduate degrees, all of them. And if you look at the data, those are the most liberal people in America. They're the people who,
yeah,
they're
I mean, three of the justices that were on the Colorado Supreme Court that held that Trump should be off the ballot graduated from these Ivy League law schools. But this is why we're already out of time. But Cleta Mitchell, we'll have to have you on again. But this is why judicial elections matter. This is also why it matters who we put in office to get to nominate these judges to begin with. So you can always reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net. Keep praying for our country. I'll see you tomorrow morning. We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.